And if you can fulfill that vision and you can kind of share that with him when you see it finally done, it's all worth it.
This is the Action Filmmaking Decoded Podcast. A podcast dedicated to raw action analysis.
Ooh, my gosh. For fans of action cinema out there, how badass would that be?
Each week, we bring you a new action filmmaker to break down your favorite scenes.
360 off a person, round kick the guy from a 360 spin.
Now, introducing your hosts, Darren Tun and Mike Messina.
Hello and welcome back to the Action Filmmaking Decoded Podcast. I am your host, Darren Tun, and with me is my co-host, Mike Messina.
Hello.
For today's guest, we have Justin Eaton. He is known as the stuntman and double in Banshee, Doctor Strange, Daredevil, The Punisher, and Falcon and the Winter Soldier, where he was Emmy-nominated for his stunt performance as Captain America, John Walker. Fun fact, he is married to our previous guest, CeCe Ice, stunt double for Black Widow and Scarlet Witch. Now we have some housekeeping for you guys.
First off, we are on Patreon. So for as little as a dollar a month, you can help support the show. If you enjoy our content or want exclusive access to video breakdowns from Darren and I, consider supporting at patreon.com/actionfilmmaking.
Yes. And you can also help us out by leaving a review on Apple Podcasts. Just like the next big singer did, they wrote, "Super detailed and awesome to listen to. The podcast has been consistently thorough in its review of scenes and chock-filled with interesting information." So a big thank you to the next big singer for that review. So now, Mike, what are some big takeaways from this episode?
It was really dope hearing how a stunt actor is involved in not just action, but also the horror scene. So we found out Justin's a really big horror fan. I'm also a really big horror fan. He was playing a creature killer in American Horror Story for a certain season's stretch. And it was just awesome to listen to that experience and also hear how secretive they were, how they had to sort of sneak him around corners and stuff so no one would see him in costume, and how he would sort of jump out and scare people on accident because he's such a nice guy, of course.
Yeah, he tells a little bit of that story in there about how he rounds some corners sometimes and there would be, you know, I guess an AD or a PA or something that would accidentally see him and then just get shocked or scared.
Yeah.
Just because of like how great the costume and the makeup was. I also really enjoyed hearing about how, you know, the whole American Horror Story family is literally just so close and so welcoming. And it didn't really even feel like, you know, that horror kind of set to him. It just felt fun and I guess loving. Very, very big contrast to the actual show and probably not what you'd expect.
Brings you closer together. Unless you're Kubrick. Everyone else in the horror comes closer together.
Yeah, definitely. He also talks a little bit about his early Bo Staff videos as Expert Village Bo Staff videos, where Mike and I dug that up a little bit more. And it was definitely a fun time, especially hearing about his older, you know, competitions and tutorials that he taught.
Yeah, I mean, back in the day when a younger Mike was training Bo Staff, I must have went onto YouTube and seen those videos of a younger Justin Eaton showing me how to do neck spin flippy dips with a Bo Staff. It must have happened.
Yeah, he was definitely the guy, the Bo Staff guy. I'm pretty sure. He gave us a little behind the scenes look at, you know, what was going on while he was filming those videos. I guess he was a little sick at the time, so he was like sweating a lot. And I thought it was just because of all the Bo Staff work that he was doing, but he was telling us, yeah, he was actually quite sick while he was doing those videos. So yeah, without further ado, here is Justin Eaton, part one. All right. Here we are with Justin Eaton. How are you doing?
How's it going, Darren, Mike? How are you guys? Good.
Great.
Doing well.
So I think the first thing we want to mention here is your Emmy nomination. Big congratulations on that. We were wondering how the night was.
Oh, it was amazing. You know, you grow up watching those award shows and stuff. And all of a sudden, through happenstance and luck, I feel like, we were able to do it. And we were able to be there with a lot of close friends, very talented people. Like, we knew everybody that was nominated, everyone else that was
nominated. Oh, great.
Wow. Coordinators category and everything. So it was great. It was a fun time. I'd do it again if I could.
Yeah, I was taking a look at a lot of CeCe's stories after that. She seemed very proud, very proud.
Yeah, she's one of those awesome, supportive wives. It's amazing.
Yeah. So I guess speaking of married life, and I see the swords in the background from last time. How many swords like do you have again in your house?
Well, they're not all up.
Okay.
We have that guy, and then including training swords, there's probably like 30 or so somewhere in here.
Oh my gosh, really? Wow.
Yeah, I used to have a very bachelor looking place, swords on the wall and all this stuff. And I was like, maybe for our home together, some of these don't need to be up. So yeah, we have that guy up on display. And then I think that's the only one actually up and out. But as far as katanas and rapiers and all that stuff, they're in every closet probably in the house.
Yeah.
Nice. So you're prepared just in case if you ever need to break into action.
Someone comes at me with a glove and a dual challenge, I am ready.
Yeah.
Nice. And have you heard, you know, speaking of on-set couples or action movie couples, have you heard about Yung Lee and Meng Erzang for Shang-Chi?
I have not.
Okay, yeah. So for the Shang-Chi guys, Yung Lee is one of the action choreographers for that movie. And then Meng Erzang played, I think, Xia Ling in the film.
Okay.
And those two met on set and they hit it off. And I believe they're married now. So there's another...
that's another on-set couple right there.
Yeah.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah. I mean, it's funny. Some people have asked, you know, how do you make that work? Because the schedules and everything. But at the same time, you know, the schedules can be tough, but two things that are always great that come out of it. You have someone that understands it for sure. And you always have someone that shares your passions at the same time. So that understanding is even brought to another level. And I think as long as you guys, and this is something I repeat to everybody, no matter what your circumstances and your relationships, as long as you guys can communicate, everything will be great. It's great to hear about
communication.
That's awesome.
Yeah. Congrats to them. And I think CC said basically the exact same thing as well about communication. So that's
good thing you guys are on the same page.
Pass that on.
We were thinking about getting into, I guess, your early background in gymnastics, martial arts, performance arts, and stuff like that. We saw a couple Bo Staff videos on YouTube. And we were wondering how you got into that whole thing, Bo Staff competitions and the like. Yeah.
Well, yeah, like you said, I had started in gymnastics, and that myself and my two older sisters were doing it. And it was something we went to Interstate Gymnastics, a shout out to Interstate Gymnastics back in New England. And it had kind of taken over all of our lives. We got really obsessed with it. And then I kind of just hit a wall. I was like, I don't think I want to really do this anymore. And my mom was like, well, you have to do something. Okay, I'm going to figure out something. So for a year, I did nothing. And she was on me, you have to do something. I literally was getting off the bus, and a kid that got off the bus, some other kids started hassling him. And they didn't actually get into an altercation or anything, any physical, but he kind of, you know, talked to them, and we were walking in the same direction afterwards. And I had asked him, you know, wow, that could have gotten bad. And he was like, well, you know, if it comes to it, you know, I take martial arts at such and such a place. Casio's True Martial Arts, they're still kicking around.
Oh, really?
Casio. And I was like, well, that could be interesting. I'd love to come check that out. And I went to my first, not even class, it's like 15 minutes. They just kind of see if you can stand upright. And yeah, I fell in love with it like right away. They were very strict on when you could learn certain things, as you should be. But I was a little rebellious and really wanted to be Donatello.
Mm.
So I bought a bow staff off of Century Martial Arts. And every day, before class, because I used to go from open to close, and I would bring my staff, and before, probably about an hour before, and as long as they let me stay after classes were over, I would do staff in the back room by myself, just imitating videos and whatever I could learn. And then, yeah, I got onto the NASCA circuit, which is a New England-based martial arts performance circuit, and they do sparring and forms and all that stuff. I was super scared. This guy named Alberto Friedman, who got his black belt and 3 degrees in Japan. He's a part of, I believe he's still a part of the Taekwondo Olympic Committee. Total badass, 6'4", legs.
Oh my gosh.
12 feet tall. He really instilled that kind of passion to go out and compete on the circuit. And we started doing live shows, as you said, with Sideswipe, Matt Mullins, Chris Brewster, Jackson Spidell, Craig Henningsen, all those guys. And so I was doing live shows with them, and I ended up in Los Angeles, and I was broke. So broke. At the time, I think I was actually sleeping on Matt Mullins' couch. thank you again, Matt Mullins. A company had reached out to my buddy Chris Brewster and said, hey, we'd love for you to do some how-tos. You know, is there anyone else in your crew? And he was like, yeah, well, I just got it to staff. I can do some common stuff for you. And so the morning I woke up to go in and do that, I had 101 fever, diarrhea,
oh
sick, and flu. And so I don't know if you noticed in some of those videos, I'm like, okay, guys. Because I'm not breathing through my nose at all.
I thought you were just out of breath. Yeah.
Oh, no. I was direly sick, just chugging Dayquil in between takes.
Oh, man.
But it's crazy to go back and watch those videos because, you know, coming from a performance style of everything and very kind of following somewhat of a strict version of rules, I'm not really applying that to film or television or anything like that. To go back and see what that was and what it transferred into is really cool because they are still up there. Some of them, I think, are labeled as Muay Thai fighting staff videos or something for some reason. It's not Muay Thai.
Re-uploaded as that title is what you're saying.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. Wow.
it was a very interesting time, but I remember that because Cece was teasing me one day about how my stuff is still up there. And she was like, man, you look so young. And I think I was 16.
Wow. You had the long hair and everything.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about that. Yeah. Oh, man. I could use some style back then. No.
And so Muay Thai, maybe not the first word that comes to mind when you're thinking about bo staff and performance arts and stuff like that. If someone were to ask you what kind of martial arts you were doing back then, how would you describe it?
I would use sport martial arts or XMA. Mike Chat, phenomenal martial artist, many martial arts schools. He had kind of helped bring a lot of that stuff under one umbrella, calling it XMA, because there wasn't really a particular style. When you're doing those competitions through NASCA and Yale and all those other circuits, it's really an eclectic blend. It's a little bit like skateboarding, I've always compared it to, because you can have 10 people do the exact same move or trick, but they're going to have a different style, a different flair. They're going to come out of it differently. And it's all because everyone will come from a different style, a different background, and they're all coming under one umbrella. So I call it sport martial arts, really, because it's mostly performance-based.
Gotcha. Do you have any names for tricks that you have in your head that you're looking to name a kick, like in skateboarding, if you do a trick first?
The one that comes to mind, it's a staff trick. And I did a lot of training. Shout out to Nate Andre, did a lot of training and work with. And we would go to YMCAs at midnight and use the basketball court or ballet school at 2 a.m. He had coined a number of phrases for some other things that he had made. And I made one that is called the soap drop, which probably won't translate well. And it's impossible to show you, especially in this square box, without standing on a broomstick, at least. Like I said, there's so much creativity. So you could have someone do the exact same thing that I might call that, and they would call it something else because they're entering a different way. Or it's really about a style. That was a big draw for me the entire time doing that stuff, is that it's about style. You know, and once you have that confidence and you competed for a little bit, your style is really what got you through. If you had solid technique and then you made it your own, that made you stand out.
Interesting. I guess having taught all these like instructional videos and stuff like that, if you're going in and teaching someone new about bo staff and whatnot, what's like the first thing that you would start them off with?
Stances.
Stances, okay.
Almost no matter what you're learning in martial arts or in boxing or anything, if you're standing up while you're doing it, your feet are the most important thing, in my opinion. I know some
Okay.
But all your power, your speed, everything comes from your stances. So I always started with that. And I think some people were kind of bored for the first week of my lessons because I was pretty rigorous about that. Because it all, like I said, I think it all comes from there. So if you're doing that wrong,
right,
it doesn't matter what the top half looks like or what you're doing. You're never gonna be as good or flow as well as you could without your stances.
And then the second week you get into the tricks and stuff.
Yeah, doing 540s and stuff, second week.
Yeah.
Yeah. I did trick a lot, and it's stuff that I do for work now. But when I was competing, predominantly what I did was actually bo staff. And so when I would teach, a lot of the times when I would go, it would be bo staff work. And so I always did a lot of striking first. As fun as all the flair and everything is, I tried to come from a fairly traditional base because it very quickly can go from martial arts to baton twirling. And so I always wanted to be careful to make sure anyone that went out and said, I trained under so-and-so, you could strike and you could have some application. But yeah, then you get into fake neck rolls and all that kind of stuff, which looks great on camera too.
And I guess jumping in from all that bo staff stuff, I heard in another interview that you did the Doctor Strange stunts as well. And you used a lot of like the Chinese style influence, kung fu and whatnot. Can you talk about like your early experience with training kung fu and how that, I guess, helped you with that project?
Well, I was very lucky for the people that I was working with. I feel like I always am. There's so many talented people. But Travis Wong, when I was working on the project, was the fight choreographer, fight coordinator. And he has just a phenomenal background. So he helped me a lot with creating that. And Guy De Silva, my other half in the fight
he is amazing.
The times that I was doing. yeah, just two phenomenal people. So I'm just walking in going, you guys, just show me how to do this. Because I didn't come from a traditional Kung Fu background.
Okay.
You know, I had a lot of different eclectic training and stuff like that, working under different styles and different masters and things. But those guys really helped me a lot. That's a big shout out to them too, for all that work.
A lot of shout outs.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Well, we'll keep a running list.
I'm a big fan of It Takes a Village because it really does. And this job in general, it doesn't matter if you're the best stunt person in the world or the best whatever. You can't work well with people and recognize that they're just as important as you are, if not more.
Mike, I know you had a question here about the reels.
Yeah, I mean, we saw a couple of stunt reels actually online. One was from
three different channels, right?
Yeah, from like three or four different channels. I think one was Ninja Brewski and then some numbers after it. Do you know that channel or who that is?
Ninja Brewski, I'm going to blow him out of the water right now, is Chris Brewster.
Oh, okay.
Growing up, the phenomenal Daredevil double, I mean, Charlie Cox, the actor who plays Daredevil, has oftentimes said that he's half Daredevil and Brewster is the other half. And I actually grew up on the circuit with Brewster, and everyone called him Ninja Brewski because he was just this crazy flipping kid, super talented and very motivated. And so that is a very old handle that has just stuck. So I hope he didn't want to keep that a secret because that just made it not a secret.
Yeah, it's exposed now.
Old nicknames, old screen names are fantastic. I love seeing them crop back up.
Because I blew him out of the water, I'll tell you one of my very first email addresses. BigDragon101.
That's so fantastic. Now, 101.
I was waiting in line for that one.
Yeah, I know. Same.
Settle for 102 is horrible. And I saw your more recent stunt reel had, you know, Doctor Strange footage in there, Vampire Diaries footage in there. I know a lot of Vampire Diaries diehard fans. At the end, there's a little audio clip of someone saying, Justin, are you okay? After, I'm assuming, some stunt happens. So now I have two questions off of that. The first is, what stunt was that from, if you remember? And then, were you okay, as the woman was asking afterwards?
I remember what stunt it was. It was actually, as that reel opens, there's a shot of me. I hit a mini tramp backwards. Let me explain that better. Usually when you hit a mini tramp, if I'm running towards it, I'll hit it this way. We had a height limitation. It was actually on Vampire Diaries, I believe. And they wanted to simulate a vampire throwing me between, there was pots and pans hanging, and then the kitchen counter. And I had to clear that, and then the gap between to the sink, and there were breakaway cabinets lining the far side of the wall. And so if you hit the mini tramp this way, it has a tendency to send you upward. So I like to flip them around, clear the front, so that it sends you a little bit more out, because I couldn't go high because of the pots. So that very first clip of that reel, me going into those breakaways, which was super fun. That was an awesome day. We got to do so much stuff. And then he goes, you want to break all that? And I was like, yeah, sure. Let's do that. But at the end of that, I hit all the glass, and there's tons of glass. The entire thing, as I said, is breakaway, but the front is glass. There's breakaway plates and candy glass, wine glasses, and all sorts of stuff just lining that. So they were like, when you go in, obviously, you know, close up, but you might get cut up going through, because as much safer as candy glass is, it is still glass and it's still very sharp and can hurt you. Cut you pretty badly. So I hit and I go down and I'm supposed to be unconscious. So I'm not moving, which looks great. And that's how it's supposed to be on camera. The person is unconscious, but it always makes everyone on set very nervous. It's like, is he okay? Is he really? Yeah. So that was that same gag. The audio is from the end of it, is from the gag at the beginning. And it's our first AD on the show, double checking that I'm okay. And if I let the video play, you just see my arm come up in a frame with a thumbs up.
Oh, okay.
Nice.
Yeah, I thought that was a fun way to just close it out. Because so many, you know, you get asked that all the time. As a stunt performer, if you're working on a good set where people, you know, care about your safety, which isn't always the case, most of the time, though. That's standard. You don't want anyone to come running in after you've done a gag. Because even in something like that, where it's not involving an explosion or anything like that, there is glass everywhere. So if someone comes rushing in, oh, I don't know if he's okay, and they slip, trip, and fall and land on that, you're going to get gashed up. And if I'm already okay, you've hurt yourself for nothing. So it's always, Justin, you good? Throw a thumbs up or a thumbs down, depending. Yeah. And then you get up and dust it off.
Have you ever thrown a thumbs down? Has that ever happened?
Not a thumbs down. I gave one of these before.
Okay. Thumb sideways kind of thing.
I could tell you that story. So yeah. I don't know. It actually looks pretty straight on camera, but you see, this finger is just a little different than the others. I was working on Punisher season one. I was doing a stair fall on Punisher season one. Eric Linden was John Bernthal's double, and Eric did a great job, did a gag, got tweaked, and I just came in to fill in for him second half of that season. So I'm doing a stair fall for him. And through a series of different events, we end up doing another stair fall on a random night after we had kind of gotten it already. But they move camera and I do it again. Well, I know when I get to the bottom of the stairs, go, 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 boof, and I'm sitting there. I'm just outside the edge of frame and all they can see is my boots. So I hit the landing and I look down and this finger is pointed that way. I'm like, oh, wow. I just dislocated my finger. Well, no big deal. So I'm trying to get it back and it won't go back. Tom Williams, our amazing stunt coordinator on that show on season one, looks down at me and he says the standard, Justin, you good? And so from up there, when I go like this, he can see that my finger is pointed the wrong way. So he goes, come up here. And that was one of those things where I learned that you can actually double dislocate finger joints. I had no idea, because that's why I couldn't get it back in, because I'm thinking, okay, it's either rotated or it's, so I'm just stretch and then, okay, it usually goes back. Mm. And it wouldn't. So
it's two different directions.
Right, exactly, at the same time.
My gosh.
So Marvel made me go to the hospital for that, which as a stunt performer, you're like, no, I'm fine. We'll get it back and I'm going to go back to work. It's a finger. It's fine. They made me go to the hospital and I go and they take some x-rays and the x-rays are hilarious because the finger's still like cockeyed out like that and the rest of my fingers are straight. And then the doc goes, all right, cool. Let's get that thing back in. And for a full 30 seconds, he's putting his body weight into it, trying to get it back. And then it goes and makes that exact sound.
That loud.
Very loud. And he goes, there it goes. And I was like, what happened there? And that's when he told me, oh, you double dislocated. You were only relocating in one direction. And that's why it wouldn't settle back in. I was like, oh, okay. That's
at least you learned something from it. Gained something from the visit.
Yeah.
And like I said, I have great photos of the x-rays, which are hysterical.
Was it as satisfying as it sounded from our end to feel it go back into place?
Yeah, to pop it. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, and that sound, that verbatim, I was surprised. That is exactly what it sounded like. That is so weird. Like I thought I misheard it or something. But yeah.
Where's that coming from?
Yeah, it just kind of started like by the time I got there and he was literally putting his body weight in, I was like, all right, that doesn't feel great. And then it went back and it was like that cold rush of water up my hand. And I was like, oh, okay, great. I can go back to work.
Yeah.
Nice. I'm glad the hand is still okay. Fingers in one piece.
Oh, thank you.
Was that like your worst injury, would you say?
No, that's on the low end.
Low end. Oh, man. Okay.
Yeah. CC and I are in the same mental space about it. We don't talk about our injuries a lot. Like we've had family members, like what's the crazy injury?
Yeah.
And obviously you don't want to scare your family either. They know that there's danger involved, but like anytime I've gone to the hospital, ring, hey mom, just so you know, I'm okay. I'm at the hospital. You're okay? Yep. I'm going to be fine. I'll let you know anything you need to know. What do you do? Okay, good. Love you. Bye.
Yeah, because you don't want them to worry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She's already like, he's at the hospital. One I'll say that was long lasting to deal with was actually, I separated this shoulder. That was on Abe Lincoln Vampire Hunter years ago.
Okay.
Nice.
Long story short, I slam it into the ground and I get up and that shoulder is just, I'm like, what did I do? And Dave McCumber is working on the show and he looks at me and he goes, oh, that's separated. We should get you to the hospital. So we go to the hospital and the doctor takes some x-rays and he's playing with it. They end up doing an MRI. We sit down in his office and he goes, okay, so it would have been better if everything had just kind of torn, but it didn't. Things are still attached, but what you did was you stretched everything out to the extent where like a bowstring on a harp or a violin, when those strings start to pluck, that's essentially what you did by stretching it as far as you did. So now you have to wait for everything to tighten back up and then you can start to strengthen it. Whereas if it was just a clean break, we could slap those two back together, put a bow on it quicker. So that took a very long time. This collarbone still sits up in the air. It wasn't a whole lot of pain, but it was, I couldn't do push-ups for 2 years. on his shoulder.
Wow.
So it was long lasting.
Yes, definitely have residual effects from that one. But now I can do push-ups.
Yeah, all right. You're all right now.
14 years later, I can do
push-ups. Yeah.
Things going on with your body. You were in American Horror Story. There was a lot of makeup and monster creature sort of action going on there. I'm a big horror fan. I hear you're a big horror fan as well. And of course, being part of that project, pretty awesome.
Oh, yeah.
Were you excited to play like the creature monster? Was that a big deal for you?
Like you said, I'm a big fan. And when I got the call to go in to work on American Horror Story, Tim Davison was that stunt coordinator for season 2 when I first went in. And I had no idea. He was like, I'm going to have you come in and play this guy. And I went in, and Mike McCash and Aaron McCash, amazing. They've won every award for makeup that you can possibly win many times over. And they're phenomenal people. They slipped this mask over my head, and they're still working on it. They're finalizing. And when I actually kind of get to peer through the eye holes and I see myself in a mirror, I was like, just blown away. It's such a cool thing to be able to do that kind of thing. For one, because it's so rare you get to. But two, you get to, in that opportunity, you get to explore different styles of performance and things. I was overjoyed to play Bloody Face. Well, I'll say anytime he's in the mask, I got to play Bloody Face. Obviously, Zachary Quinto did a phenomenal job in that character and playing everything. But I have to say that is still to this day one of my favorite jobs, working on American Horror Story season 2.
Wow.
Playing Bloody Face, and then we got to play Raspers, those creatures that are in the woods.
Yeah.
Hours of makeup, just they cover my head, and they had makeup where they taped my lip over, and then they put pieces over that, and I had fake teeth in, and they'd have all these pieces running down my torso and down my legs. Like, it was just such an amazing process. I think now I don't know if I'd have the same level of patience for that kind of time in and out of the makeup. Not to mention when we shot the episode that takes place during the storm. They had those giant wind turbines going, and it was already like 40 degrees, and they're throwing water and fans and stuff. Mm. That was a little bit of torture, but man, it looks good.
Yeah.
They did such an amazing job. Like Ryan Murphy's he just has such a vision. And if you can fulfill that vision and you can kind of share that with him when you see it finally done, it's all worth it. But yeah, that was definitely one of my favorite jobs of my entire career. Such an opportunity. Another shout out, Tim Davison. He kept me so busy on that show. I got to play an orderly as well. I got my face ripped off.
Awesome.
Yeah. Which was really cool. That was funny about that job and a number of the ones around that. I couldn't tell my folks really, like, hey, go check me out on this show, because it was such a wild out there show.
Mm.
And so, funny little story. I was like, guys, you can't watch this show. I'll send you little clips of the stuff I'm doing, but please, it's not up your alley. Eat inside of my family, my dad, my grandmother, they get together one night and they're like, we're going to watch this show.
Oh, no.
And so they accidentally end up watching the first episode of the first season of American Horror Story.
Okay. Wow.
And there's a guy in it.
It's pretty gruesome, yeah.
I get a call the next day and my dad says, well, we made it about 20 minutes in, but I really just, I couldn't. I went, you watched it? He's like, yeah, we saw, you know, episode 1 of the season. I went, season 1? He goes, yeah. I go, oh, no. My grandmother watched that.
What are they normally used to watching?
Anything with a beautifully religious and godly message.
Okay.
That kind of transition was
total
a
opposite.
Start.
Yeah.
A little different.
Yeah. So I always just took screenshots of things that I had done on the show, and I'd send it to my family and go, please don't watch any of this. If you don't hear me say you can watch it, please don't.
Yeah.
Nice. No, I'm a huge fan of horror, and being able to do that. I loved actually being full costume and Bloody Face. And it doesn't really show up much on the show, but the character is actually, he's got that big trench coat, the mask, gloves, and everything. But underneath the trench coat is a woman's nightie. Wearing a nightgown underneath it.
Really?
And most people, like, you never heard about that. No, I didn't see that posting boards. And so it was interesting the first day putting everything on, but then you put everything on and I tried to kind of change my stance and how I walked and you know, just fulfill that horror story, that Jason kind of, you know, march. Mm-hmm. And so I remember many times rounding the corner and, you know, some awesome crew members would just turn and, you have to warn me. And then I'd speak in my normal voice. Oh my goodness, I'm so sorry. And it would like ruin the facade for them. So I stopped speaking entirely just to keep the facade going.
Did you do that purposely, just rounding the corner just to scare people?
I started being so careful after that because I didn't want to scare people. Because believe it or not, it's strange. There's two sets that I've been on that I have always kept in the regard of being the happiest functioning cruise I've ever been around. And it was How I Met Your Mother.
Oh, yeah.
Just it's such a joy. Everyone, it seems like everyone is family on that show when they were shooting it. And they had been going for so long. But that show, and actually American Horror Story, season 2.
That's awesome.
Wow. Everybody just loved each other and every department supported every other department. And so everyone was just so sweet. I didn't want to mess with anybody.
It's like a big family. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Which is strange for such a horrific show.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I would have never expected, but.
No, absolutely. Like, almost like the crew was like method and everyone is just kind of dark and sinister. But no, everyone was beautiful and lovely. Like, yeah. Yeah, but I love
it. It's normally on those sets where you never, expect that, it turns out to be that way, right?
Yeah, for sure.
I'm sort of curious because, Halloween's coming up. Do you kind of get a little bit desensitized or underwhelmed by those costumes now because you've been in so many like incredible prosthetic makeups and whatnot?
I love it when people put their best effort in to a costume. People can be so creative, especially, but like you said, like people in the film industry can just absolutely wow you. The McCashes actually were kind enough to invite me to their house one year for Halloween. And of course, they themselves are special effects makeup artists. And then a lot of their friends are special effects and they all love horror. So that there was more than one time that I jumped at that party because those guys just blow any costume out of the water. It's amazing the kind of stuff that they do. But I used to go pretty ham on my Halloween costumes. But obviously last year there was, I don't think we did anything for Halloween with COVID and everything like that. Who knows about this year,
Hopefully something.
Yeah, I'd love to do something, even if it isn't on Halloween or, we'll do a Zoom party or something. We'll all play the same music.
Yeah.
But yeah, Halloween has got to be one of my favorite holidays.
Wow. Okay. A lot of people say Christmas, but that's interesting. I mean, obviously you loving the horror movies. Yeah.
Yeah, Halloween for sure. Halloween beats pretty much all of them. Although Cece is changing my mind for Christmas because her family has so many great traditions that they have around Christmas. And so this past year, we were able to share a lot of those. And I was like, this is moving its way up.
Yeah.
it's above Easter now, for sure.
Oh, okay. So I know Mike also had a question here about the ghost hunters, right?
Yeah, when we had Cece on, she mentioned you seeing her a while back on some kind of, I forget which one, some kind of Ghost Hunters reality TV show. Is that, are you entrenched into reality ghost sort of media? Are you a believer, I guess?
I used to be. I will say this. I think that there's a lot of things that we don't know and don't fully understand. And I will leave room for any discoveries that come. I know a lot of people have had different instances and things that are kind of unexplained happening to them. I could say that I feel I've had a handful of those as well. So I was always very fascinated with those shows, especially when they started doing those cool reality shows about them and going to these different places. But I remember one day, who had sent it to us? Her friend Patrick, who was also on the episode, I believe, had sent her the clip of Ghost Hunters when they were there. And she goes, oh yeah, did I ever show you this? I was on and I'm watching it and I go, I've seen that.
Yeah.
I saw you. Like,
you just didn't connect two and two.
Right, exactly. Well, at the time, we didn't even know each other. And so, when I hadn't heard that she was on it, and she goes, oh, yeah, I was. And this is the clip. I was floored. It was amazing. But yeah, I've always, like, being a fan of horror and stuff like that, I always love to hear some of the, what you could say, like, real life instances of people's interactions and their experiences in those. Like, when I went to New Orleans, one of those, like, high-ranking activity places. People always say that they have an experience somewhere in some way, shape, or form. And
really?
They do a number of different late-night tours. I was floored. It was so much fun because you could literally take maybe a mile circle, and with someone that knows some of the history could tell you every building, something that's happened in each of those buildings and the corresponding story and how people have experienced things since then.
So. Wow. It's so funny how like they start to tell you and then you start to think about it and you're like, man, maybe there is something weird about this place and you start to see it in like a different way.
Oh, yeah. Well, The thing I always bring up, because I think it's ridiculous, how many hotels or motels or anything, how many buildings have you gone to that there's no 13th floor?
Mm-hmm. Right, like when you go into the elevator, there's nothing labeled 13, right?
Yeah, in a huge way, there's enough people, at least that build buildings, that believe that having a 13th floor is in some way bad luck. So it's I think a lot more people have interest and belief in it than they would care to admit to.
Okay. A little bit subconscious too.
Yeah. Oh yeah, for sure. And the black cat thing, like Cece and I are looking to adopt a cat. We would like to get a black cat. And we're like,
oh, okay.
People are going to not want to come to the house. I don't know. If
yeah. Be great for Halloween though.
Yeah, absolutely.
Who knows? Yeah. From here, I guess we would like to jump into individual works and questions about that. But before we jump into that, I kind of was wondering, do you have like a favorite scene or part from your work that I guess most audiences haven't really noticed or asked questions about that you wish, you know, got more attention and you wish, you know, you were like, wow, that was a big standout moment for me?
Good question. I will say a huge job, generally speaking, in my career, I called it my crash course in stunts. There was an amazing team of people around me that had tons of experience and were willing to share with me. And I learned a lot and was able to do a lot in my career for the first time, which was Bunraku.
And
most people have not seen that. The star of that show was Josh Hartnett, but had a huge cast. Gackt, Ron Perlman, Kevin McKidd. Just a huge list of people that did all these cameos on the show. And we shot it in Romania over 6 or 7 months. And it was very early on in my career. I was supremely lucky to be in the spot. It was a long time ago. Clayton Barber was our stunt coordinator. Larnell Stovall, two more shout-outs, two amazing people. It was one of those things where obviously a lot of people didn't know, but I think it got released in maybe 2 theaters in this entire country. But we did a lot of stuff in that. We had 120 beat Warner between Josh and one other actor. And the camera just goes around. They do 120 beats. And so there was a number of those kind of singular moments in that show. And everyone just worked their asses off, honestly. Chris Brewster was on that. Aaron Tony, Holland Diaz, Fernando Chin, all these like megastars in the stunt world. And they were all there. And then there was me. Just this very new kid who got lucky with an opportunity. And they all shared a lot with me. And that's why I always call that my crash course. I learned so much on that show. And I'm very proud of the work that we got to do on that show.
Awesome. Were you on that show for a long time? Or was it just a brief stint?
I was there for the full, I want to say it was 6 months, maybe 7. But yeah, we left, went to Romania for 6 months. Hadn't been to Europe, anywhere outside of the country, except for maybe Canada before that. So it was jarring in that way too. But yeah, we were there that whole time, just doing the run. But yeah, it was an experience for sure.
Wow. So cool. Didn't know that.
Like I said, most people haven't heard of the film, but it was a very unique take. The director wanted it to feel like you lived in a paper universe, he called it. So everything is kind of folded almost like origami. Everything is kind of...
A paper universe. Oh, okay.
Paper universe. It's very interesting. I would recommend it. The first cut of the film, I know we shot so much. The first cut of the film was like over 4 hours. So then they did a number of cuts and brought it.
That was the director's cut right there.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Get several buckets of popcorn and just sit down. Like I said, I was very, very proud of that. We did a lot of work and the actors did a phenomenal job on that because we asked them to do quite a bit too and they stepped up.
Wow.
Awesome. Yeah.
I'd love to jump into, I guess, Banshee from here. I know Mike has probably some questions on Banshee.
Let me just start super general. Can you tell us a little bit about Banshee? Familiarize the audience a little bit about what the show is.
Banshee is about an ex-con who gets out of prison, finds himself in a small town and ends up in a position where he takes over the identity of the local sheriff, and nobody knows who it's a new sheriff, so no one knows who he is. And he takes over. This guy has some happenstance things happen, and Lucas Hood, played by Anthony Starr, steps in. And ultimately, he's in this small town because he wants to get the love of his life back, they were both part of this life of crime, and she kind of tried to disappear from it in this small town. He finds her when he gets out of prison, and the only way to be near her and fight to get her back is to assume this role. And so as violent as the show is, it's actually based off of family in its own kind of twisted, you know, violent way. It's
sort
it's
of way, really, yeah.
It's a crazy love story. And all the interactions that kind of come to first and second season, they really are based on fighting for the people you love. It was a phenomenal show to work on. Big shout out to, obviously, Anthony Starr, who was just phenomenal, really did an amazing job with it. Hoon Lee, I love Hoon Lee. You'll find him in the Badlands. And he's like, he's just a genius in life and in his art. So many other people, Ivana and everyone just on the show, they were great. And we had a great stunt team. Marcus Young headed everything up. Dave McCumber, Rich Citrone, Mike Wilson, Danny Boyer. We had a blast on that show. It's one of those rare opportunities where the director would look at Marcus and he'd go as violent as you want and we'll dumb it down after that. And there was a lot of times where they didn't even dumb it down. They're like, this is gross. We love it. And yeah. We just end up shooting that.
It's always better to go so extreme and then take it down a notch from there. It seems like that's the approach for most, I guess, coordinators and for the films that we've interviewed.
We're going to go long and we're going to go as violent and brutal as we can. And then we're going to go like this.
And that trend seems to follow too. The director seems to love it. And then the whole thing just gets, you know, put into the final cut.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Which is great. I mean, cause I always applaud that, you know, if they're asking for something, give them what they're asking for and a little more or a little different. Cause no matter what, even if the director doesn't go for it, that's just something that goes in the grab bag for the next job.
Right. Right. And that's like a little sequence that you can use next time, like you said.
Exactly.
Definitely. It was some of the best action scenes for television I've seen. And I saw there's a whole gang of different articles from different entertainment sites, things like that, just breaking down the action of it itself. Because it's not just high quality. It's also there's so much variety in it. And it's obviously a team there who's trying to bring it to the next level and keep changing it up. Keep having it fresh. And I know one name that you mentioned again was Dave McKember. And there's also a whole lot of recurring names that keep popping back up for a lot of your projects. What's that working relationship like between you and Dave and just in general, you and people who you've been able to keep working with over and over again?
I'll start with Dave. I love working with and for Dave McKember. I will always, till I'm done, say he is perpetually overqualified for every job. He has such a passion and a drive, and he's super intelligent. He's a sponge. Anything he doesn't know, by the next day, he's mastered. But he's also very open and receptive to other people and their ideas. I love collaborating on a fight or a project with Dave because everything just flows so well, and there's not an ounce of ego to that man. I learn something from him every time we work together, and he's one of those stunt guys that's really a filmmaker. He has great passion for making quality film. And like I said, he's always trying to continue learning. And he might have entered from the stunt side, but that man will direct and they will be awesome projects.
Yeah, reminds me of Garrett Warren a little bit now that we're talking about it. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And there's a number of guys like that who want to continually get better. I mean, Sam Hargrave.
Definitely.
Sam Hargrave. One of the best stunt performers of this era, and he's directing now. You know, every time he goes in, he wants to set a new bar.
Yeah,
and that's someone that isn't just passionate; they're obsessed in the best way possible, and it's a healthy obsession that just keeps making the rest of us want to push harder.
Yeah, Dave sounds amazing, and obviously, congrats to his Emmy nomination as well for stunt coordinator.
Oh yeah, he and Hank did a phenomenal job. I don't know if you guys have heard anything about Falcon Winter Soldier, but obviously, it took place we hadn't finished, and the pandemic hit in, and all those different things, all those different obstacles to deal with. But Falcon Winter Soldier was a 9-hour movie, and to try and just take hold of the reins of that and the amazing things that come out of Marvel nowadays. You know, there's a standard that's set to try and get that done, but it is, as we often call it, the Marvel machine, and it moves at a pace. And if you don't move at that pace, it's going to chew you up. And Dave not only worked at that pace, but he kind of picked it up and brought everyone else up with him. I will say with complete confidence that without Hank and Dave, that show never would have finished.
Wow. He had a huge hand in it.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, because it is such an action heavy show. So much depends on making sure the action is organized and it continues to tell that story and that you can get it done in the appropriate time. It doesn't cost $1 billion or anything like that. So you have to be creative in those ways. And I think Dave gave up on sleep about 3 months in and just kind of, I'll do it later kind of thing.
Yeah, we'll catch up, you know.
Yeah, exactly. I'll sleep when I'm done. That's what Dave does because he wants to make sure he puts the best thing out there that he can. And he never gets enough credit for that. So I will always be singing his praises.
Not what you expected. Get down on your knees.
What? Here?
My employer wanted you to know.
I know while you were doing Banshee, you did a short called Identity Crisis, and there was a lot of gunfu in that one. I was wondering if you could break down that short. Yeah.
Oh, yes. So Hoon Lee again. So that was something that Dave wrote, and we shot that. We were in our fourth season of Banshee. There was an old, I think it was an old, like, nuclear site that they had abandoned, and then they had cleaned it up, and that was where we were shooting Banshee. Those were our sound stages and offices.
Yeah.
And we were moving through it, and I was like, this is a really fascinating building. Like, you could really shoot some stuff in here. And so we shot that over 2 weekends while we were shooting Banshee. And Dave went to Hoon and said, hey, you know, this is something, if you wouldn't mind giving it a read, I'd love for you to play in it if you'd like to. And Hoon was so down. He was like, whatever you guys need, whenever you want to, I'm here. Let's do it. Because Hoon was one of those guys on the show. His character, probably four or five scenes that he was actually doing action, either shooting a gun, extended, or having a fight or a chase. But he trained with us almost every day for 3 straight seasons, trained with us almost every day. And so he was ready to do stuff like that and then some. So yeah, Dave pitched it to him. Hoon's like, yeah, let's do it. We went to Target, bought some costumes.
Oh, nice.
Had some airsoft guns. And yeah, over the span of 2 weekends, we shot that. And that was one of the passion projects that Dave had. And just another example of him, okay, this is something that I haven't had the opportunity to do yet, or at this level, or with this kind of talent. So let's try it.
So it was an idea at the back of his head for like the whole entire time.
Yeah, he had written that. I want to say he said he had written that. He would go back at night after work, and one way that he would kind of wind down is he would, you know, write a little more. And he got it to a place where he was like, I think this is worth doing. You know, it's not going to be our, you know, our Oscar winner, but this is great practice for everyone. It's something that we could put out. I can practice this, and these guys can have a little bit of that. And yeah, and it was a really fun thing to do. I loved fighting such a talented guy, and I thought the end was really funny. So I was like,
yeah, it was.
You gonna tell him?
Nah, yeah.
Don't worry about it. And the other two guys that at the end are actually two of the guys in our stunt team, Danny Boyer and Mike Wilson.
Oh, okay.
Who had been helping work behind the scenes throughout the entire thing, and then we were like, well, who plays them? And Danny and Mike were both like, we'll do it. We'll absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, I had a little bit of that comedy in there mixed with the action. It was pretty good. Yeah.
Well, and something I wanted to add as far as, like, you know, Dave taking something small and just diving down the rabbit hole with it. If you watch the fight scene on the roof, anytime you're seeing the sky, Dave did that. Because we shot it over the span of 2 different weekends, the sky was completely different from one weekend to the next. So all the cloud cover, even the hue and the color of the sky and everything, Dave went in and would, like, and place clouds after the fact so that it would match better. And it's like, oh, this shot, I actually liked how it looked on this day. So I'm going to change all of these shots to look like this one. It's one of those things where you can watch and go, oh, that was cool.
You wouldn't even have known. We didn't even know we watched
exactly.
It.
Yeah. Because he did it so well, you wouldn't know how much effort you're actually seeing.
Wow. Dedication. Right. Dedication.
I did lose a pair of shoes doing that, actually.
Oh, really?
Because it was super hot on the roof. So when we went up to do that scene, and by the time we got to the end of the second day, the sun had been beating down on the roof. And it was you know, an older building that had the old, like, paint out tar on the top. And that had heated up to, like, gum. And so I did it. And we're doing the scene, and I'm like, what the heck? And half my shoe had just started melting from the bottom, and it had that tar all over it. So I just donated.
Oh my gosh. Nice. Wow. You win some, you lose some.
Yeah. It's very funny to me how so many times you hear about filmmakers, you know, long, hard day on set, whole week or, you know, 6 month length shoot. And then when they're finally done, they have a break, they have a weekend, they go and they make more films and they just keep doing it again and again.
Yeah, absolutely. I've written a lot of different things. I haven't shot a lot of my own passion projects because they just keep stacking up. Mm-hmm. But when you have the opportunity to do that, especially after working with someone with such talented people, it's not like when kids are in college and they want to make student films, so they have to do that for a class and stuff like that. Everyone's learning as you go. But after a short while working in this industry, there's people that have so many passions that you know that the stuff you don't know, someone else is going to know. And the stuff that you all know together, it's going to be stellar. So you get the opportunity to kind of flex those muscles and get a little more proficient and flex your creativity a little bit and learn and make some mistakes. But it's never a bad process.
It's kind of like an outside film school.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Because someone's always has, you know, some insane $20,000 camera rig set up with lenses. Because that's their passion. And then this person has a whole lighting kit. And then someone else has all the props you need in the world. So it's a big group effort, but it's fun. It's always fun.
Yeah. Always a way. There's always a way.
Yeah, absolutely.
And let me double back quick to a scene from Banshee. And if anyone wants to look it up at home too, you can find it on YouTube. It's from Cinemax's channel. Season 3, it's Lucas versus Chaitin, fight scene 2. And I think this is one that also popped up on your stunt reel.
In the pit.
In the pit.
Right, right.
The lady caught it. She was your woman? Good.
You versus Chaitin, who seems to be a very large gentleman. Can you, just give us a rundown of what's going on here?
Well, as far as the show is concerned, Gino Seegers plays Chaitin, Littlestone,
right,
who is not little at all. But in the top of season 2, there is a murder, and Lucas Hood, needing to continue to play this role of the local sheriff, has to investigate it. And Lucas Hood also, he has a good heart and really does want to get to the bottom of it. So he starts putting in effort, obviously not in the way that a law-abiding sheriff would. He breaks some rules. And they have a whole big fight. That was actually my first fight on the show. But when they meet again, it's a little bit more on Chaitin's terms. It's in this fighting pit. It's totally a legal fighting pit where people die all the time. And Hood's there to try to get some answers. And of course, there's several layers of different things going on within that. But yeah, that was definitely another. I mean, both of those fights, the first one and that second one, Hood gets his ass handed to him.
Yeah, looks like that. Yeah. And
just kind of gets a little luck in there from time to time. But that was, as I said, Gino Seegers. He comes from a wrestling and rugby background. He is a phenomenally strong, very strong individual. But he has great control and is a very loving man. He also comes from musical theater. He was on the Traveling Lion King show and is an amazing singer as well.
Oh my gosh.
That's awesome.
It was such a joy to work with Gino. Multi-talented. Oh, yeah. Yeah. And you know what's funny about that is in his first appearance in the show, that was supposed to be it. He was supposed to come in, do that, get arrested, disappear. But we all loved him so much, and production loved him, and all the writers and directors were like, we have to make more for this guy. And so he ended up playing throughout the rest of the series of the show because he's just a dedicated, talented, sweet man. But yeah, it was great to be able to do those scenes because a lot of that stuff is with Gino himself because he is a very physical and capable person. But yeah, he's strong. There's one shot I know that's in that old reel where it's him. He picks me up and throws me through these wooden doors. And I remember we had just kind of rehearsed it. And I was like, well, yeah, and anywhere you need to like grab or anything. So he's got me by the shirt. And then I remember he grabs my belt. And I remember Danny Boyer is counting it down. 3, 2, 1. And on that lift, I can feel his strength because I am not helping. On the way up, like I started to, and I was like, he doesn't need me at all. And then he just hocks me. But yeah, that was an intense scene. That was a really fun thing to do. And Marcus Young shot second unit on that. So we got to have a little bit more control as far as how that got shot and really try to highlight things as best we could. And yeah, that was a joy. That was a really fun time.
All the scenes in Banshee are amazing. I love how there's a little exchanges here where he's not just fighting like a big dude or you know, the quintessential big guy. There's some nice wrestling exchanges, like you're saying. There's a point where your character has an overhook and then Jaden's able to sort of transfer to a back take and all these things that are going on. Is there ever any, I guess, first of all, was it a challenge trying to reconcile that size disparity and give Star's character a fighting chance? And is there ever a worry that the audience might not pick up on certain intricacies of the fights that are going on?
I think for these two characters, it wasn't really as difficult to deal with the size disparity because they are two completely different fighters. And the attributes that make Chaitin so formidable are kind of the things that play, in a way, to Hood's strengths. Hood's is, he's not really so much as a trained technical fighter, as Antony would like to joke, I don't do moves. But his character is like Rocky. I will always get back up. So the bigger and the stronger you are, that just means you're going to get tired faster and I can take whatever you're going to throw at me. And so we tried to work small little bits of intricacy, cat and mouse kind of stuff in there without making it look too technical. And we actually did a lot of research. We actually had a number of Native Americans come in to the training space who had learned traditional weaponry, and they brought in traditional weapons and showed us some of the techniques that they actually had been passed down.
That's so cool.
And we tried to incorporate as much of that as we could to be respectful to everything that we possibly could. We didn't want to just make him a big oaf, just, you know, clobbering time. Because the character of Chaitin is a very traditional man, as brooding and as unrelenting and downright mean as he could be, he was doing it from a place of his heritage. Mm-hmm. So we wanted to try and pay homage to that anytime we could. And so any of the small details, there's always going to be details that are kind of just in there for us. We always hope that someone will find those little Easter eggs and stuff.
Those action movie fans. Always,
right. You know, that's, you know, we can make fights all day and have them try to give them as much meaning as we possibly can. But when you get there on the day, if the director wants to shoot something from a different angle or doesn't want to include this part of the fight, or we don't have time, or, you know, any number of things can come up, those things will get lost. Yeah, there's always little bits and pieces somewhere in there that are just for us in the end.
Nice, nice.
Yeah, and that's interesting too, talking about the sort of Native American consultation. We see so much of Eastern martial arts, karate, kung fu, you know, you name it. Certain cultures don't really get name dropped so much in terms of action movies, compared to other ones. So I feel like that alone is definitely worth a look. Of course, everything else that goes on in that show as well.
We were very happy to have that challenge, but also that opportunity to try and show something that people hadn't seen. You know, when we tried to do that with our Native American ninja, as we called her, when Dave McCumber's character that he's doubling has his interaction with, that character name just jumped out of my head. The whole fight starts with her throwing a tomahawk and it just sticking into his shoulder, and pretty much separating everything, but he still manages to fight for 3 or 4 minutes, which is amazing. It's so Banshee, as we'll say. We tried to not just pull like, oh, let's make her look like this other person you've seen before. Let's make him, you know, he's a Hulk guy or whatever. We tried to really do our research and come up with something that was not just fun to watch, but interesting. We wanted to intrigue you just a little bit. And it's funny, I actually have a tattoo that I got. I could say it now because who's going to sue me now? The tattoos that Chaitin has, all those intricate ones that went up his head and across his chest.
Yeah.
He had one over here that was a tomahawk, only, you know, it was across his chest, so it was like that big on him. But I actually have that same tomahawk.
Oh, nice, nice.
On my foot. So I have a little bit of Banshee with me everywhere I go.
Yeah, yeah.
That's sorry awesome. To put my feet on camera, but
yeah, no, it's okay. Yeah. People that watch the video version are the only ones that'll benefit from that. So
That's the incentive.
Yeah. I mean, now that you brought it up, we definitely wanted to talk a little bit about tattoos because, I mean, that seems to be something really big for you. And I saw on your Instagram you got a couple different ones. I guess maybe if you could talk a little bit about that before we jump into the next film breakdown.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's see. Some of my, well, I'll say my favorite one that I have. It took some time, but it's a very phenomenal artist in Long Beach. Her name is Ivana. Her Instagram tag is Ivana Tattoo Art. She is one of the only tattoo artists, or the only tattoo artist, to have an art award out of Italy. All of her pieces are singular and one of a kind. And so another, I guess, tag for the video watchers. Let's see if we can get this whole thing in here. So there's this top
hat. Oh, wow. Wow, that's actually bigger than I thought. I didn't know that was on your leg.
Yeah, the whole quad.
And then that's crazy.
Continues down into... This is an owl.
Wow.
Okay.
But her color application.
Yeah. Line on the top half in the quad area. Owl on the bottom by the side, by the calf.
How long did that whole process take? That whole leg tattoo.
I got the face of the lion done in 1 8-hour session. I got busy with work and never got the chance to come back. Because obviously you want to leave time for everything to heal. Because the last thing you want to just get this beautiful,
right. It's in different parts.
And then go to work and smash the grab out of it.
Yeah.
So I got that done. And then actually about 3 years ago, after I finished Jumanji, I went back to Long Beach and sat for 3 days in a row for eight or nine hours each. And we finished the lion and did the owl in those 3 days, which was, it was a lot for 3 days. Because then I got on a flight and my leg was already swollen. Then I got on a flight with depression, blows up. And
oh my gosh.
Her work is singular. It's amazing. I highly recommend checking her
out. That's crazy.
Her process is very interesting because I don't know how well you can see in the video, but there's so much color and mm-hmm. shading within color from one to the next, and everything just kind of flows together. But she doesn't, a lot of times you see people that are doing color tattoos and they have 40 colors, 40 cartridges of ink just laid out and all this stuff. I think at most at one time she had 5 different colors out. And because her process is almost kind of like layering. So she would take like a 4-needle or an 8-needle gun and she'd go with one color and then she'd pick up a little more and she'd go over it with a different color to kind of change the hue, and then she'd grab another color and she'd start working around the edges. And it was an amazing experience, and she's so phenomenally talented and very motivated and driven. She really doesn't come from much, and she has built up so much for herself and does her own thing the whole way.
Did she do that other tattoo as well, the Banshee one that you were showing us before?
She did not. That was actually done in North Carolina.
Oh, okay.
That is verbatim. I took a photo because they had Chaitin's tattoos up on one of the walls.
Yeah.
And so I took a photo of it, and I literally was like, hey, do you mind doing this? And he just, yeah, sure. Printed it off. Shaded it out.
Gotcha.
I'll say my other favorite tattoo is these I have in my hand.
Oh, nice.
This here, and this here. This is my personal little family tree. My mom and my two sisters, my father and I, and my grandparents that had passed away. And so that's, and they're small enough where they don't really affect work. I always keep my own makeup on me, but.
Yeah.
Them also being ones that I get to see all the time because they're right there in my hand.
So it's a good reminder for you. Yeah.
Yeah. The whole family's coming with me. And now, away.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That's true. All right there on the hands. Yeah. And again, for those audio listeners, three knuckle areas, you got some very, I'll say minimalist black ink going on.
Yeah.
Very, each representing different family branches for you. Awesome. Mm-hmm. Love it.
Yeah. But I think I'm up to like 13 or 14 different tattoos now.
Wow. And does every single one have that sort of, I guess, emotional attachment for you?
I've always tried to do that. Of course, there's ones that I'd like to change now, but the meaning or the reason for getting them is always, I always try to make that something strong. You know, sometimes people will look at it and it's like, oh, well, I've seen that before. Like this one. This is just a red sun. It literally is a stamp that you can find on the wall of any tattoo shop. Mm. So its design is not something that was created for me, but I got this tattoo after a few years in Los Angeles. I had been in the business and really been pushing, and I had started to really have some success, and I was thriving, and I was very proud of that, in a place where at the time, I think they said the average for someone to be there was 10 months. Because for the for most people that had moved there with the passion of, you know, being an actor or whatever it might be,
right.
They ran out of money and left within 10 months. And so I had hit my, I want to say my 4-year mark of being there. And I was incredibly proud of that. And coming from a small town in the middle of nowhere in Massachusetts and being able to do that is something I never thought I'd be able to achieve and continue to get better at. And so this is my sunny Southern California tattoo. Just remind yourself that at a time when you weren't sure you'd even be close to be able to do it or accomplish what it was, or even know exactly what it was you were trying to accomplish. You just kept pushing and you've been able to succeed at least this much so far. And so that's kind of the meaning behind that one. So it's not a super creative, you know, design of a tattoo, but
it means a lot. Yeah,
absolutely. And I think they should. You know, I think it's fun to just get a random tattoo. I have an actor buddy of mine who just, he likes ketchup, so he has a bottle of ketchup. Oh, yeah. You know, and those are always fun to do if you enjoy tattoos, because they can be addictive too. But I've tapered myself and really just been very specific about what I want to get, where, and why. You know, what's the point?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Gotcha. No ketchup just yet.
Yeah,
yeah. No, not yet. It would probably be some version of barbecue sauce anyway.
Yeah.
Or sweet potato. It'd be like a sweet potato fry. Man, sweet potato fry.
Underrated. I'll say that. Very underrated.
And I've said this before, and I guess now in retrospect, I'm probably glad. But if I didn't have this job, I would probably have been sleeved a long time ago. But with the opportunity to be able to double actors and need to look and perform as if you were someone else, that makeup team looks at you and you're sleeved up and down, there's a higher probability of you losing that job.
Unless you're Tom Hardy playing Bane.
Right. Yeah. We actually, on Banshee, we needed someone to come in and do a job, and they were going to be doubling an actor who would have fake tattoos, needed to be covered head to toe, because we had, you know, Native Americans, we had the Amish community, but we also had Nazis on our show. We had hired someone to come in and, hey, do you have any tattoos? Oh, yeah, I just got one. Oh, okay, cool. Yeah, no worries. They can cover one, but then, you know, they'll need to put other ones on you. Well, this performer came in and the one tattoo he had was just all the way down to forearm, you know, 3/4 sleeve. And he's got so makeup not only has to cover all of that, but then they have to convincingly put fresh tattoos over it. And so in an instance like that, there's a really good chance I won't ever play or double someone in a loincloth, because most of my right leg is tattooed. Now, I always have my own tattoo makeup with me. I'm always prepared to cover them myself and often do. But if that's ever a problem for anybody, I'm always very forthcoming. Do you have any tattoos? Yes. Here's photos of them, where they are and how big they are, because I'm not going to create a problem for someone else. These are my tattoos. I love them. But that doesn't mean that someone else has to spend 6 hours covering them up, you know?
Yeah.
Any dream roles that involve loincloths then?
Yeah.
Or is that, we're okay shooing that one?
Yeah. Tarzan. I'm just dying.
Oh, no. Yeah.
No.
You got to do your version of that then.
Yeah.
It'd be a modern Tarzan. Well, I guess modern Tarzan would be like Spider-Man, though, wouldn't it?
The tattoos could work, though, for Tarzan.
They have played in my favor. I've been on shows where, as long as, you know, you have proper releases for them, if you need them, you know, they need you to look like a grueling bad guy and you need to be covered in tattoos. I go, well, I've got a number of them, and they'll just add a couple more, a spider or an 8-ball.
Oh, nice.
But they'll use a lot of the tattoos I already have.
Yeah. So nice. It's an advantage too. Yeah. You said,
it can work in your favor. Yeah, for sure.
If you liked that, please consider supporting us on Patreon at patreon.com/actionfilmmaking and leaving a review on Apple Podcasts. Stay up to date on the show by visiting our website, actiondecoded.com, and by following us on Instagram @actionfilmmakingpodcast. Until next time, thanks for listening.